Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 314. Wednesday, November 17th, 2018.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. I'm getting ready to go to Politicon on Thursday of this week. I mean, Politicon doesn't start till Saturday, but I'll be traveling on Thursday, setting up there on Friday, and then Saturday and Sunday I will be at the convention. This will be the first time I've been to California since the 2013, I think it was, manifesting in Meatspace road trip that Olga and I took. And it will be the first time I've been to Los Angeles since 2010, when I was there with Neil Kramer. We stayed at the home of a longtime friend of the Sea Realm, Bruce, who no longer lives there. He lives in Colorado now. Don't know when I'll get to Colorado next. So I will be there at Politicon. I will be there primarily to promote the webcomic, which is quite the amazing opportunity that, you know, not only do I get paid to make this comic, but I get flown out to Los Angeles, and we've had life-size cutouts of the characters made that will be at our booth. And really, I don't know that I have any assigned duties. The Center for Progressive Urban Politics is taking several other people to act as journalists, so I don't know that I'm necessarily going to be interviewing people, at least not for CF Pup. I'll take my own recording equipment, and I will catch little interviews, little conversations, little fragments of things to share with you while I'm there. But for the most part, I think I'm just there to sort of, you know, be present, make people aware of the comic, answer questions as need be, and soak up the vibe, and basically just be another point of view, another presence. So I'm using Twitter a lot more now that I've been kicked off of Facebook, and I will be tweeting from Politicon. I will always try to include the Politicon hashtag. So over the weekend, you know, either check in with my Twitter or just go to Twitter and see what people are posting with that Politicon hashtag. I'm also looking into the possibility of making just, you know, little easy videos. And I think probably I'll just be uploading them to YouTube, unedited things, just, you know, grabbing little fragments of things with my phone while I'm there and uploading to YouTube. I will be posting links to anything that I put on YouTube to Twitter. So follow me on Twitter. Something I don't say usually, but I might as well start giving out my Twitter handle. It's KMO spelled out phonetically. So it's capital K A Y E M M O. Although I think if you just go to Google and you type in the regular KMO and Twitter, you'll find me. Also, there's a link to my Twitter account from the crealm.com page. So to get us started, this comes from Twitter. I noticed, you know, I just went to my notifications. I saw that somebody had followed me, and I looked at their account to see if I wanted to follow them back. And they were a comedian, and they looked interesting, so, you know, I followed them back. But in their bio, they listed hashtag POYB, and I didn't know what that stood for, so I went and I researched it. It stands for Proud of Your Boys. So this is something that somebody would put up to signal their affiliation or at least their sympathy with the Proud Boys organization, which, you know, if you don't know anything about it, I'm probably not the best person to introduce you to the concept. But one of the co-founders of Vice Media, Gavin McGinnis, he had a podcast, a very popular podcast, and he started calling his fans the Proud Boys and started holding events, and basically it took shape from there. Some people say that they are basically brown shirts for Hitler, and, you know, Hitler being Trump, of course. And other people say that, you know, they are the embodiment of a proper masculinity, you know, pushing back against the ideological and intellectual abuses of feminism. I guess. I mean, that's just off the top of my head, and I don't claim to be particularly well-versed in the Proud Boys. I know that a lot of people have been, you know, I would say pearl-clutching, but you could say, you know, demonstrating or signaling a righteous concern over the fact that the Proud Boys are some of their gear, like t-shirts and things, offers free helicopter rides. And this is actually a reference to the Pinochet government in Chile, where they disappeared, you know, political dissidents and opponents, often taking them up in helicopters, flying out over the ocean and just pushing them out. So that's ugly, we'll admit. But just on the hashtag POYB Twitter page, you know, just investigating that hashtag, there's a guy, his name is Daniel Daly. I don't follow him, don't know a thing about him, but he posted a link to a Huffington Post article, and he issued it with this challenge. Read this article out loud to someone else, and I dare you not to laugh. So the article is pro-Trump gang seen in video assaulting anti-fascist protesters in, and that's as much as the that's as much of the headline as I can read from Twitter. So popping over to Huffington Post, it's in Manhattan. Proud Boys, a misogynistic and anti-Muslim proto-fascist group, pummeled anti-fascist protesters outside a Proud Boys event at a New York Republican club. This is by Christopher Mathias. So there's the description that Huffington Post gives of the Proud Boys, a misogynistic and anti-Muslim proto-fascist group. So this is something that I normally would not do. I am going to read this cold. I have not read, not even a paragraph, the thing that I'm about to read out loud to you. This is what's known as a cold reading, and it's something I don't normally do here on, well, any podcast, really. And so to preserve the flow, I'm not going to edit out flubs. So you'll get to hear basically what I record before I go back and, you know, cut out all the mistakes. New York. Minutes after an event at a Manhattan Republican club meant to celebrate violence against leftists, attendees belonging to a proto-fascist group, pro-Trump street gang, reportedly pummeled three people on the sidewalk in Manhattan's Upper East Side while shouting homophobic slurs. Footage posted online by video journalist Sandy Bachom, that's B-A-C-H-O-M, shows a group of men who appear to be Proud Boys, a misogynistic and anti-Muslim fraternity, known for committing acts of political violence across the country, kicking and punching three apparent anti-fascist protesters as they lay prone on the sidewalk. "Do you feel brave now, faggot?" one of the attackers yelled, according to Bachom and another journalist, photographer Shea Horse. Another video shows multiple attackers yelling, "faggot." Both Bachom and Horse told HuffPost they believed the altercation began when three anti-fascist protesters knocked a red Make America Great Again hat off a Proud Boy member's head. But then, the two journalists recounted the confrontation turned into a mob assault, with Proud Boys vastly outnumbering the anti-fascists. Quote, "They turned it into a pummeling," Horse said. There was three people on the ground and people just kicking the shit out of them," close quote. The violence occurred just minutes after roughly 30 apparent Proud Boys exited the Metropolitan Republican Club, the GOP's headquarters in New York City, where Proud Boys founder Gavin McGinnis had been invited to give a speech. And the article includes a tweet by Shea Horse, one of the journalists who witnessed the event, and there are some photographs here in the tweet of somebody on the ground and somebody standing over them, kicking them, and other people gathered around as if they were going to be participating as well. Shea Horse tweeted, "This is one of those nights where things seem even more fucked up when editing slash reviewing my photos. It wasn't until I wanna editing that I realized how many fights were happening at once." So the HuffPo article continues, "McGinnis billed the event as an anniversary celebration to lionize a Japanese ultranationalist who assassinated the head of the Japanese Socialist Party with a sword on October 12, 1960. McGinnis wrote on Instagram this week that he would be reenacting this inspiring moment at the Metropolitan Club. A video posted on Twitter by Fox News shows McGinnis waving a sword outside the event. Fox News misleadingly implied in its tweet that Antifa, or anti-fascists, had been responsible for the sword and the violence. And then Christopher Mathias inserts one of his own tweets. He tweeted, "The dude with the sword? That's Gavin McGinnis. founder of the far-right fascist gang, the Proud Boys. The vandalism? No evidence that it's Antifa. The violence? Videos from last night show about 20 Proud Boys beating three people while they're on the ground. This is so infuriating. And the tweet includes some video from Fox News. According to Backham and Horse, some 50 anti-fascists protested outside McGinnis' appearance at the Metropolitan Republican Club. Kill more Nazis, they chanted at one point. Video footage from Backham shows dozens of apparent Proud Boys piling out of the club as anti-fascists chant after them. Cops kept the two sides separated, Backham said. The violent confrontations occurred just a few minutes later when three or so anti-fascists confronted the attendees on 82nd Street between Park Avenue and Lexington Avenue, she said. The footage shows cops arriving on the scene and eventually breaking up the fight, but then allowing the Proud Boys, group members are known for wearing black Fred Perry polo shirts, to walk away from the scene. I don't know what a Fred Perry polo shirt is. I know what a polo shirt is. Anyway, Backham's footage shows them then walking through the streets of Manhattan, belting out chants of Uhuru and I Like Beer, a reference to the U.S. Senate testimony of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who had been accused of sexually assaulting a girl when he was in high school. The group even felt emboldened enough to pose for a photo. And here's the photo. Shows a bunch of, young men. Can't even say young white men, as I see a variety of skin tones there. I see three red hats, baseball caps, one of them turned backwards, but I'm guessing they're Make America Great Again hats. There's, 15 guys in the photo, something like that. And this photo is one that was edited. This photo is one that was posted by Shea Horse, known on Twitter as Hunted Horse, or at Hunted Horse, capital H, Hunted, capital H, Horse. Shea Horse tweeted, be interesting to hear how often I say that and how comfortable I get saying that. I'm not comfortable saying it now. The Proud Boys even waited to do a group photo after the fights. They were hyped the fuck up after that, flashing their white power hand symbol before marching towards a downtown train. Huh. Okay, one guy up front is flashing a peace sign, just the index finger and ring finger up, the rest down. And then I see a lot of people doing the OK sign, which now, after the Kavanaugh hearings and some 4chan trollery, I guess is now a white power symbol. The HuffPo author continues, asked about alleged assaults near the Metropolitan Republican Club, a New York Police Department spokesperson said three people, two 20-year-olds and a 35-year-old, were arrested at the corner of 3rd Avenue and East 48th Street a little before 9 p.m. They were each charged with assault and robbery. One man was charged with resisting arrest. The NYPD could, quote, not confirm any known group association, close quote, of those arrested, or, quote, whether or not they attended the event, close quote, at the Metropolitan Republican Club, or whether they attacked anyone who did attend, the spokesperson said. The department added it wasn't aware of anyone being hospitalized. Police were also investigating vandalism at the club Thursday night. The unknown vandals spray-painted anarchy symbols on the club's front doors, broke a window, and left a note decrying the club for inviting, quote, a hipster fascist clown to dance for them, close quote, a reference to McGinnis. The Proud Boys are listed as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks extremist groups. Although Proud Boys claim to disavow bigotry, its members are routinely revealed to be white nationalists or have connections to white nationalist groups. Jason Kessler, the organizer of the deadly white supremacist rally in Charlottesville last year, where a neo-Nazi drove his car into a crowd of anti-racist protesters, killing Heather Hare, was a Proud Boy. So, not the driver of the car, but the organizer of the event was a Proud Boy. McGinnis, a founder of Vice Media, has written articles for white nationalist websites including VDare.com and American Resistance. Once asked by a New York Press reporter what he thought of his neighbors in the Williamsburg neighborhood of Brooklyn, McGinnis responded, quote, well, at least they're not, and I'm guessing it's the N-word, it's N**RS, or Puerto Ricans, at least they're white, close quote. He later claimed to have been joking. McGinnis regularly incites Proud Boys to commit acts of violence. In 2017, he said Proud Boys, wishing to become a fourth-degree member of the group, the highest rank, had to, quote, get beat up, kick the crap out of an Antifa, close quote. McGinnis called this reporter a member of Antifa, then claimed it was anti-fascists who instigated the violence Friday evening, including by, quote, hurling a bottle of urine, close quote, at him. Quote, I recognize one of them, he said in an email. He was there for an hour before the talk screaming at people. He stole a Proud Boys MAGA hat and was immediately tuned up. You guys picked a fight without the means to back it up again. Actually, there's a dash there. So, you guys picked a fight without the means to back it up. Again. Close quote. Quote, fuck around and find out. Close quote, he added. This is a developing story. Check back for updates. Again, the author is Christopher Mathias. That's M-A-T-H-I-A-S. National reporter for Huffington Post. Well, I read that aloud. I didn't laugh. I mean, you can tell from the title. Proud Boys, a misogynistic and anti-Muslim proto-fascist group. You know, what Christopher Mathias' point of view is. It does seem clear, even from his perspective, that there were people there basically looking for a fight. McGinnis was inside a building giving a talk. His supporters were outside, and people who don't like them went to that location and provoked them, and apparently some of them got beat up. Anti-fascists, or Antifa, beating up people whom they outnumber greatly is their calling card. I mean, that is just that is what they're known for. And according to the journalists, who seem pretty anti-fascist leaning, Bakum and Horse, some 50 anti-fascist protesters outside McGinnis's appearance at the Metropolitan Republican Club were chanting, kill more Nazis. So it sounds like this is a fairly evenly matched standoff. It's just that in a couple of, you know, photo opportunistic instances, there were Proud Boys, you know, around somebody who had been downed, and that leftists on Twitter would have you see that as the definitive character of the event. But it sounds to me like there was about 30 Proud Boys and about 50 Antifa shouting at one another, insulting one another, and occasionally it would come to blows. I mean, I guess I can see why somebody who is sympathetic to the Proud Boys would say, read this and try not to laugh, because, yeah, it's pretty slanted and, disingenuous, but it's nothing particularly noteworthy as far as I'm concerned, you know, knowing the political stance of the Huffington Post. So I am going to put that in the podcast, I guess, just hopefully to elicit some feedback and get some discussion going. But I think the feedback from that experiment is don't do cold readings of things that you don't really know what they have to offer. So now I'm going to go over to the Sea Realm podcast group on MeWe, which is still very low traffic, but it's pretty good because, you know, it is high quality traffic. The few people who are posting regularly are the heavy hitters. So recently I've been posting articles about universal basic income. Just a few days ago, I subscribed to Medium.com. Apparently I had read too many of their articles, you know, to keep reading for free. So they wanted a $5 monthly subscription from me in order to read any more. And because Medium pays the people who write for them, I thought, well, yes, I'm happy to pony up a little bit of money for things that I'm reading so that the people who wrote the things I'm reading can get paid. But most of the things that I read on Medium are things that I find objectionable. So I am paying to read things that I disagree with and that I know I'm likely to disagree with. So, of course, most people posting about universal basic income on Medium are in favor of it, and uncritically in favor of it. So here's just a short quote from one of the pieces that I read on UBI on Medium. Quote, the idea is gaining traction in many countries as a proposal to soften the edges of capitalism. Though the details and philosophies vary from place to place, the general notion is that the government hands out regular checks to everyone, regardless of income or whether people are working. The money ensures food and shelter for all while removing the stigma of public support. Close quote. To which I responded, This basic framing is so blinkered and stupid, it's breathtaking. UBI, without a rigorous and aggressive program to keep landlords and financial rent seekers from capturing that basic income, will not remotely ensure food and shelter for all. To which regular contributor Mark C. responded, devil is in the details, indeed. This is one of those rare ideas that could lead to really unfortunate, dystopian even, ends, or be a boon to humanity. And I agree, if done right, if done with an eye to preventing opportunistic players from just soaking up that UBI, that citizens' dividend, leaving the people who most need it as desperate as ever, you know, if you do account for that, this could be helpful. Although here is the main objection. It just comes in the form of numbers. Round off, 300 million Americans. You want to give them $10,000 each. What's 300 million times 10,000? 3 trillion. That's about twice what the U.S. spends on all forms of targeted public assistance now. So basically doubling the amount that we spend on public assistance and giving it to everybody regardless of need. That $3 trillion price tag for, you know, giving everybody $10,000 a year. $10,000 as a base salary, I mean, you're not going to live on that alone. If you do, it will be a very impoverished lifestyle. In most places, that won't cover your rent. But it would probably result in a lot of people hooking up just so that they could pair up for a one-bedroom apartment. But it would cost $3 trillion. I asked Alexa today, what's the GDP of the United States, and it's $19.3 trillion. So that proposal would mean devoting about one-sixth of the gross national product towards paying everybody this $10,000 a year, you know, base salary, citizen dividend. Does that seem like a lot to you? One-sixth of the productivity of the country being devoted to basically just paying the people to be the people. I imagine a question like that gets immediately to your basic political philosophy. What is government for? What is society for? Is it a context in which individuals, based on their own merit and initiative and other praiseworthy attributes, can make an honest living and amass a legitimate fortune? If so, diverting one-sixth of all that activity to basically paying people for not doing anything would seem morally questionable at best and, you know, and probably worthy of moral condemnation. Or is the purpose of society to allow humans to survive together? I mean, that's the purpose of the basic human grouping, the band. But as it scales up and it becomes less personal and more abstract, does that basic purpose of human cooperative action remain? Okay, so moving on from there, Dryland Fish posted a link to a manifesto called UBA, a manifesto on the topic of UBA, which is Universal Basic Assets. I'm going to read the beginning of this. I'm not going to read the whole thing because it devolves into extreme vagary toward the end. But the beginning is fairly specific and I think articulates the basic ideas, the basic problem anyway, usefully. This is something written for the Institute for the Future. It's called Universal Basic Assets Manifesto and Action Plan by Marina Gorbis, G-O-R-B-I-S. Marina Gorbis writes, growing economic inequality combined with advances in artificial intelligence and automation is already destabilizing many societies. Unless we act now, the situation is likely to get worse, leading to greater social upheavals and demise of democratic governance systems. So I'm going to just jump in right there and say that phrase, unless we act now, is one that leaps out at me because, well, as you'll hear in a moment, this piece of writing speaks about 2016 in the future tense. So from the perspective of the temporal perspective of this author at the time of writing, we cannot act now. But I would say that even if as a society, you know, at a society-wide level, we did act in terms of proposing and enacting policy. The processes at work, the ones that concern Marita Gorbis, would still, quote, be leading to greater social upheavals and demise of democratic governance systems, close quote. Marita Gorbis continues, in this moment of transition, we urgently need to develop new frameworks and prototype new approaches to building participatory economies and societies that deliver both social and economic equity. We propose universal basic assets as a framework for achieving this. We need to change the game. This next section starts with a quote from Douglas Rushkoff. Quote, the marketplace in which most commerce takes place today is not a pre-existing condition of the universe. It's not nature. It's a game, with very particular rules set in motion by real people with real purposes. Close quote. Marita Gorbis continues, indeed, markets are more akin to game boards with certain sets of rules designed to optimize particular outcomes reflecting prevailing power structures, cultural norms, and technology capabilities. Take, for example, the rules governing corporations that are key vehicles of the market economy. Ever mindful of the political influence of East India Trading Company in early colonial governance, the Founding Fathers made efforts to curtail corporate power. Corporations were given charters to operate for a limited amount of time, 20 to 30 years, and only for the purpose of serving a public mission. They were expected to develop large commercial ventures like roads, canals, railroads, and educational institutions. Harvard was the first chartered corporation in the U.S. Importantly, investors in these early corporations were usually also their customers. Companies were created in order to ensure that they would provide good service at a reasonable price to the same people who pooled money to create them, not to maximize investment returns. It is only recently that the rules of the game have changed. The prevailing philosophy governing corporations has become shareholder value, making profits for shareholders the primary and typically only goal for publicly traded corporations. Rules governing corporations and the larger economy have evolved accordingly, shaping requirements for corporate formation, governance, and oversight. So I'm going to pause there and just share with you a thought that occurred to me as I was reading it, which is this. The corporation, which is organized for the benefit of and, you know, for the purpose of achieving and maximizing shareholder value, returns to investors, is so dominant now that, I mean, what would be the effects of say, the U.S. federal government announcing that we were going to be returning to the founding conception of corporations, whereby they would be chartered for a limited time for a specific purpose, and just generating a profit is not a sufficient purpose for the, you know, perpetual existence of a corporation. So corporations would be evaluated one by one, and those found to be only generating profits for investors and not achieving some other larger public good would be disbanded. What would be the effect? Well, I suppose a lot depends on the speed at which that process is carried out. Suppose the U.S. government started at the top and disbanded the top earning companies one a year. What would the effects be? Now, the top earning companies are not the ones that employ the most people. And the companies that employ few people, but in so doing reach a large audience or serve a large clientele with few employees, the employees of those companies, I think, would have a pretty easy time finding new employment, you know, particularly the ones with technical skills. But eventually we move on down the line to companies like, say, Comcast. How do you determine whether Comcast serves some larger public good or some worthwhile function other than just generating profits for its investors? Comcast has built out and maintains an extensive physical network for the conveyance of information, you know, in one-to-many style, as in broadcasting, TV shows, things like that, and in the peer-to-peer social networking sort of exchange of information. Surely that's valuable, but also, you know, Comcast attempts to create monopolies so that it can institute monopoly pricing. Should the federal government take over Comcast? And if so, how should they reorient Comcast's businesses? Should the federal government set the maximum rate that Comcast can charge its cable subscribers? Suppose the U.S. government took over all corporations which were engaged in activities which were deemed to be not providing a public good, but only accomplishing return on investment for shareholders. Suppose the government wanted to take them over and not disband these corporations, thus flushing all of its employees out into the great pool of job seekers. Suppose it wanted to preserve the employment that these companies provided, but reorient them to doing public good as opposed to just generating profit. Well, what would it cost for the U.S. government to basically take over profitable corporations and make them unprofitable? Would it cost more or less than it would to just pay everybody a base salary for doing nothing? I don't know. My guess is the latter, that it would be cheaper just to pay everybody to do nothing than it would be to take over profitable corporations and reorient them to doing something useful that doesn't necessarily generate a profit. As I say, these types of questions are easy for some people to answer because they get straight at your base political philosophy. For somebody like me who's not committed to any particular philosophy with great fervor, they're difficult questions. Continuing from the manifesto. While such rules have fostered economic growth and enabled formation of mega corporate organizations, today they are also producing highly deleterious social and ecological outcomes. This is the case for both those left behind in the economy optimizing for shareholder value and those disproportionately benefiting from it. The numbers are striking. Last year, according to a recent study by Oxfam International, the 8 richest people in the world collectively owned as much wealth as the bottom 3.5 billion, approximately half the world's population. This top number declined from 388 people in 2010 to 85 people in 2014 to 8 people today. Oxfam claims, if this trend continues, by the end of 2016, the top 1% will own more wealth than everyone else in the world combined. So clearly this is from 2015. Did that prediction come to pass? I don't know. I'm not even sure how to check. The author continues, this wealth comes at a price, not only for the poor, but also for the extremely wealthy themselves. Some have to build protective bunkers on secluded islands as they prepare for the inevitable social upheavals. Historical research shows that concentration of wealth and power requires investments in vast networks of expensive security institutions, leading to what Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld calls privilege violence. Such violence stems from a, quote, power structure that allows or enables violence against some citizens as the price for maintaining extreme privilege, close quote. The social instability caused by vast economic disparities is likely to grow deeper under the pressures of two forces. The first is the unrelenting progression of global warming that is already driving massive dislocations of the poorest and particularly vulnerable populations. Today, the global number of refugees is estimated at over 60 million people, the largest number in post-World War II history. The growth of this precarious population is not only a humanitarian concern, but also a threat to the stability of nations that are poorly prepared to cope with the sudden influx of new migrants. The situation is likely to worsen as more people are forced to leave their homes because of climate disruption. The second force, rapid advances in automation, artificial intelligence, and machine learning, is undermining established arrangements for income generation for vast swaths of the populations in developed and developing countries alike. Growing numbers of people are making livelihoods in various types of alternative, often precarious employment arrangements, gig, on-demand, freelance, etc., rather than in stable, well-paying jobs that come with essential social benefits and risk protections. Automation, global connectivity, artificial intelligence, and a whole set of new technological tools are making it possible to produce goods and services in abundance without employing large numbers of workers or engaging workers in flexible but also precarious ways. As a result, the system that worked relatively well under conditions of scarcity is poorly suited to fulfill the needs of many when products and knowledge can be produced in abundance by relatively few people or in an automated fashion. So that last paragraph, the one describing automation, artificial intelligence, machine learning, and its effects on people's ability to make a living, I think is lucid. It is well worded. I think it is fairly concise. I think that is a really well-written paragraph. So well-written, in fact, I'm going to read it again. The second force, Rapid advances in automation, artificial intelligence, and machine learning is undermining established arrangements for income generation for vast swaths of populations in developed and developing countries alike. Growing numbers of people are making livelihoods in various types of alternative, often precarious, employment arrangements, gig, on-demand, freelance, etc., rather than in stable, well-paying jobs that come with essential social benefits and risk protections. Automation, global connectivity, artificial intelligence, and a whole set of new technological tools are making it possible to produce goods and services in abundance without employing large numbers of workers or engaging workers in flexible but also precarious ways. As a result, the system that worked relatively well under conditions of scarcity is poorly suited to fulfill the needs of many when products and knowledge can be produced in abundance by relatively few people or in an automated fashion. So that's the statement of the problem. The next section begins the statement of basically the parameters of a solution. You know, what a solution would look like in very broad and general terms. So I'm going to read a couple paragraphs from this section, but then I'm going to stop because the longer it goes on, the vaguer and vaguer it gets. But the author continues, "Today we urgently need to change the rules of the economic game to allow us to produce not only material abundance for the few, but also better lives for the many. We need to build a new operating system for our economy and our global society. And with the new technologies, new geopolitical realities of a highly interconnected world, new knowledge accumulated over centuries of human endeavor, we have the tools to do so. Recently, many people and organizations have been coming around to the notion of UBI as the solution to the growing inequality and looming automation. This concept involves providing unconditional payment of some amounts of money to each individual in a society. I would argue that this is a good interim or partial solution, but by itself it does not change the game or the operating system that creates highly inequitable economic returns. In a world in which monetary rewards increasingly accrue to capital and not to labor, economic disparities between asset or equity owners and everybody else are likely to grow ever larger as a result of automation and network dynamics that foster creation of monopolies or oligopolies. If we are serious about changing the game, we need to focus on universal basic assets, UBA, a core basic set of resources that every person is entitled to, from housing and healthcare to education and financial security. In designing UBA, we should take into account equitable distribution of traditional physical and financial assets like land, money, and goods, as well as the growing pools of digital assets, data, digital currencies, reputations, etc. We should take into account the creation of new kinds of assets that recognize and assign value to exchanges we engage in as part of maintaining the social fabric of our society, but do not currently carry with them monetary value, caring, creative output, knowledge generation, etc. In essence, we need to look at the concept of assets in its broadest sense, recognizing three classes of assets: private, public, and open." So this is where I'm going to stop reading, because for me, the things that I'm really concerned about are people's ability to have food, shelter, and access to medical attention when they need it. And largely what this manifesto is proposing are new kinds of assets, like giving everybody the ability to issue their own cryptocurrency or personalized token, or, you know, some sort of limited token that they can create themselves and eventually somehow exchange for the currency that they would use to buy things. So again, this manifesto is from 2015. Do you remember circa 2015 when there were so many voices basically talking about how not cryptocurrencies exactly, but the blockchain technology that underlies them is going to change everything? How this technology will form the basis of all manner of trust networks that will create all sorts of, you know, new social phenomena, useful coalitions of people working to make the world a better place. There are some people still talking about that, but I think they have sort of cordoned themselves off into little bubbles that don't bother, you know, people who aren't explicitly interested in that. Because here we are in late 2018, and I'm still waiting to see the cryptocurrency or blockchain killer app that is going to change everything. You know, I moved from Facebook over to MeWe, but I also have accounts at other, you know, the what are they called? The alt-tech social sites, like BitChute and Gab, and there's one called Mines, and Mines issues its own cryptocurrency to its users. But just the process of configuring your account to accept this cryptocurrency, it has stymied me. I've not gotten past that point. I'm not a programmer, I'm not a techie, but, you know, I'm not a dullard either. If a venture involving cryptocurrency or blockchain is more complicated than I can figure out in a reasonable amount of time, it is not ready for prime time. I was particularly disappointed when I got to the end of this manifesto. Reading from the last section, Institute for the Future is proposing to jumpstart these efforts in three ways. One, catalyze a community of thinkers and doers through regular convenings to exchange ideas, propose frameworks, and advance solutions. It is crucial that we bring the best and most innovative thought leaders from a diversity of disciplines and communities to build a strong foundation for designing a new economic operating system built on universal basic assets. So I would summarize that as 1. Hold meetings. 2. Conduct research on various approaches to universal basic assets, particularly new types of open digital assets, as well as interactions among different types of assets. Some of this research will be technical, some of it will explore business cases, and much of it will draw on political intent. It is therefore important to engage not just technical and business experts in the research, but also policymakers and political advocates. So I would summarize that as 2, think about various proposals. And 3, prototype and seed tools and initiatives that apply the best thinking in UBA to real-world environments. We urgently need to launch the experiments that will become the seeds of rapid iteration and innovation in the deployment of universal basic assets. We need to design prototypes with different intents and document how these prototypes impact the lives of diverse participants in the economy. We need to link these prototypes to community-building efforts and measure their success against community criteria and values. We need to zoom out and see how they interact with one another and ultimately to forecast the kind of society they will create. So I would summarize that as 3. We need to try out some of the best ideas and see how they work. So those 3 proposals I would summarize as 1, hold meetings. 2, think about different things we might do. 3, try out the best ideas. Okay, well, I can get behind that, I suppose. Not that it goes very far. Okay, I'm going to read one other thing to you, which is of a very, very different nature. I mean, it's on the same topic, roughly, you know, in broad strokes, but from a very different point of view. So this is an article from the World Economic Forum, so weforum.org. It is from just about a year ago, October 2017. It is 5 predictions of what life will be like in 2030. The authors are Mike Moradi, co-founder and CEO of Sensulin, and Lin Yang, founder and president of Innovation Ideas Institute. This article is part of the annual meeting of the Global Future Councils. You are just waking up in the spring of 2030. Your Internet of Things bedroom opens solar-powered e-windows and plays gentle music while your smart lighting displays a montage of beachfront sunrises from your recent vacation. Your shower uses very little water or soap. It recycles your gray water and puts the excess heat back into your home's integrated operating system. While you dress, your artificial intelligence assistant shares your schedule for the day and plays your favorite tunes. You still start your day with caffeine, but it comes in the form of an Internet of Things refrigerator, which is capable of providing a coffeehouse experience in your home. A hot breakfast tailored to your specific nutritional needs, based on chemical analysis from your trips to the smart toilet, is waiting for you in the kitchen. When it's time to leave, an on-demand transport system has 3 cars waiting for you, your spouse, and your kids. On the road, driverless cars and trucks move with mathematical precision, without traffic jams, routine maintenance, or road rage. Accident rates are near zero. En route, you call your R&D team, who are wrapping up a day's work in Shanghai. Your life-sized image is projected into the China Innovation Center, and your colleagues see you as if you were sitting in the room. It's a bit surreal for them to see you in the morning light, given that it's dark on the Bund, Shanghai's waterfront, though the novelty fades after a few uses. You review the day's cloud-based data from your Shenzhen manufacturing hub, your pilot project in San Diego, and your QA team in Melbourne. The massive data sets were collected in real time from every piece of equipment and have been beautifully summarized by your company's AI. All these facilities are closely maintained and operated via a sophisticated predictive analytics platform. Pleased with your team's progress, you end the call and ease into a good book. This is the future, and it will be here sooner than you think. Here are five technologies that stand a good chance of impacting your daily life by the year 2030. And let me stress that here at the end of 2018, the future they're describing is just a little over 11 years from now. 11 years ago, it was 2007. Think about how much life has changed between 2007 and 2018. The World Economic Forum's forecasters are proposing that in the next 11 years, these changes will take place. 1. Say goodbye to your screens. Today's virtual reality headsets are used for consumer entertainment, yet they are bulky and isolating. In the future, light field displays may eliminate the need for a headset or display altogether, projecting 4D images directly onto your retinas from a point of focus. These devices may eventually be as unobtrusive as a pair of sunglasses. As next-gen displays replace our TVs, iPads, and phone screens, the $3 trillion consumer electronics industry will reinvent itself. Manufacturing jobs touted by politicians and lured with massive subsidies prove useful for a time, but will ultimately be swept aside by the same processes that rendered previous jobs obsolete. 2. Say hello to your pet Crispy. CRISPR, continuous, regularly interspersed, short, palindromic repeats, is a biochemist's way of saying that we can cheaply and reliably edit genes. Today's cat lovers crave exotic breeds, such as the Toyger. Tomorrow, your family pet may be a genetically engineered tiger, yet the size of a common house cat. Should regulatory bodies ban CRISPR technologies in humans, underground labs will flourish worldwide as parents aim to eliminate congenital genetic disorders or give their kids a heritable advantage in school and in life. This will create new disparities and stigmas. Criminality and human trafficking will take on a new dimension of insidiousness when genetic identity no longer can be confirmed. 2. Biofacturing, growing organs and skyscrapers. Perhaps the single most disruptive change will follow developments in genetic engineering as bacteria, algae, and other cells become the factories of tomorrow. If you like the idea of being vegetarian but love meat, perhaps you can be a degan and only eat meat that was produced without killing. Today, companies like Beyond Meat and Memphis Meats are perfecting deathless protein. Imagine a guilt-free steak with beneficial omega-3 fatty acids in lieu of cholesterol. Tomorrow, products like automobile frames may be woven from graphene and spider silk, or skyscraper frames grown from bedrock to the clouds by an array of microscopic creatures with little human intervention. Skyscrapers grown from seed? I'm not saying that's impossible. I am saying that will not happen in the next 11 years. Number 4. Ads, a necessary evil. Someone has to pay for all this change, and it is still going to be us in the form of targeted advertising. Your communications device, or whatever replaces functions currently served by today's cell phone, may be free or heavily subsidized, but you won't be able to skip the latest immersive advertising, at least without paying a fee. You will be more connected than ever before, though advertisers will find clever ways to influence your behavior based on the same biometric technology that monitors your health. 5. The age of implantables. As our world changes, scientists believe that humans' brains will continue to get bigger, our lifespans will increase, and our cultures will continue to evolve and merge as we adapt to new environments. Today, you can have 20/10 vision with LASIK. Tomorrow, you may add infrared zoom lenses to your vision, making 20/1 vision possible. Hawks are estimated to have 20/5 or 20/4. Today, we have wearable devices that can detect magnetic north and give a sonar-like capability, useful for the visually impaired. Tomorrow, you will meet your always-on virtual assistant. Eventually, our descendants will be unrecognizable. Okay, we're almost to the end of this thing, although the last couple of paragraphs are the most absurd and, I would say, for me, irritating. Change and choices. Change may arrive as a gentle breeze or as a violent Category 5 typhoon. Geographies that embrace change will enter a new age of prosperity. They will create jobs of the future. New household names will emerge, and new titans of industry will be celebrated. Those that cannot embrace change will stumble. Some countries have homegrown movements that are hostile to science. They fight the battles of the last century, engaged in recriminations of past wrongs. They politicize science while mired in debt and financial and political paralysis. It is not hard to predict the long-term results of such actions. These countries resign their citizens to the wrath of economic stagnation. Which path will your country choose? So the end there asserts that how well you do in the future will be an effect of how much your government and your society embraces new technologies and change. And those engaged in talking about the past are basically just caught up in pointless recriminations that serve no useful purpose and divert us all from the grand possibilities of the future. Now, as you probably realize, I do get fairly irritated with people who are primarily and almost exclusively, quote, engaged in recriminations of past wrongs, close quote. But I think this World Economic Forum forecast takes things to the absurd opposite extreme. This is what I wrote about this article on the MeWe group. I got into a pretty decent conversation in the comments section of a YouTube video, Wonder of Wonders, where we talked about peak oil. In it, I commented, quote, "The slim reed of my hope for the continued existence of technological civilization after the depletion of fossil fuel reserves rests in the possibility of learning to implement computational processes in biology, such that the continued production of information technology doesn't require global supply lines, rare earth minerals, enormous inputs of energy and water, and multi-billion-dollar chip fabrication facilities. If scientists can harness the already functional nanotechnology of microbiology for computation, the high-tech era of human civilization, elements of it anyway, might outlast the age of abundant free energy from fossil fuels. Admittedly, it's an unlikely scenario." And then I posted the link to this article from the World Economic Forum, and I wrote, "Check out item number 3 in the linked article, Growing Skyscrapers by 2030. That's just stupid. Even if things go particularly well over the course of this century, this isn't a development I can reasonably expect to see in my lifetime. After spinning tales of superlative tech transforming life in the next 11 years, this piece ends by scolding people about the dangers of not embracing science, technophilia, and above all, change." And again, from the World Economic Forum piece, "Those that cannot embrace change will stumble. Some countries have homegrown movements that are hostile to science. They fight battles of the last century, engaged in recriminations of past wrongs. They politicize science while mired in debt and financial and political paralysis. It's not hard to predict the long-term results of such actions. These countries resign their citizens to the wrath of economic stagnation." So I wrote, "These single mentions of debt and economic stagnation are the only acknowledgement that economics have any role to play in the future of human prosperity. There is no mention of inequality anywhere in this piece. Occurrences of the word capitalism in the linked item? Zero." To which Mark C. responded, commenting just on the whole article, I guess, and the whole lifestyle described therein, "Actually sounds awful to me. I think personally one of my issues is that if these predictions were true, you would be reduced to complete tech dependence and the assumption that technological change equals general good or the general welfare. I won't be refusing the basic income guarantee that people are talking about in some of your other recent posts, but I'd like to see a right of subsistence, the right to just be somewhere and live off the land. Foraging and hunting can be damaging ecologically, but I think you could set rules, perhaps not the current rules, that would make this a possibility for those who chose to do so, at least temporarily. The proposed future here would require that we just keep upgrading our lives to the next model, ever dependent on increasingly complex systems and people that we cannot know or fully comprehend. Even the illusion of personal agency disappears. Count me out, even if it comes with a basic income guarantee. This sort of tech vision seems like a kind of fencing out or fencing in, limiting control to an increasingly small number of people, selected for by the system itself, perhaps without intention at all." So Mark's closing comment reminded me something from William S. Burroughs. Again, Mark wrote, "This sort of tech vision seems like a kind of fencing out or fencing in, limiting control to an increasingly small number of people, selected for by the system itself, perhaps without intention at all." So that brought to mind for me this quote from William S. Burroughs. "We have a new type of rule now, not one-man rule or rule of aristocracy or plutocracy, but of small groups elevated to positions of absolute power by random pressures and subject to political and economic factors that leave little room for decision. They are representatives of abstract forces who have reached power through surrender of self. The iron-willed dictator is a thing of the past. There will be no more Stalins, no more Hitlers. The rulers of this most insecure of all worlds are rulers by accident. Inept, frightened pilots at the controls of a vast machine they cannot understand, calling in experts to tell them which buttons to push. Or as Burroughs said it, the rulers of this most insecure of all worlds are rulers by accident. Inept, frightened pilots
at the controls of a vast machine they cannot understand, calling in experts to tell them which buttons to push.
All right, so I'm going to get this posted for you, and then I am going to start packing. Basically getting ready to get on the road early tomorrow morning. I'm driving down to Hartford, Connecticut to catch a plane out of Bradley Airport. It's going to take me to Dulles in D.C., and then the long flight across the country to L.A. And it occurred to me just this morning. I mean, I think about and I read about and listen to the street brawls between Antifa and the, either the Proud Boys or other types of right-wing, Trump-supporting, basically nationalist identitarians. And they seem like the doings of savages in far-off lands or, political radicals in some strange country. It just seems odd that, these open street brawls with weapons and throwing urine and hurling insults and the police either intervening or not, depending on, the location and the affiliation of the police. This all takes place in places like Portland, Oregon, but it certainly doesn't take place in Bellows Falls, Vermont. But it probably will take place in Los Angeles this coming weekend around Politicon. As I understand it, there was a strong Antifa contingent at Politicon last year, and there were protests over Ben Shapiro being allowed to speak there, and Ben Shapiro is back this year, so I might get to view some of this stuff firsthand. Now, I am going to be there not on my own, but representing the Center for Progressive Urban Politics. So I need to be on my absolute best, most non-confrontational behavior while I'm there. Fortunately, 2018 is the year devoid of alcohol and marijuana for KMO, so in a situation like that, were I to be, say, at an after party with people with strongly held political views, if I were drinking, I might come on a little strong, and I might, this is even more of a danger, really, I might deliberately provoke. That has been a weakness of mine in the past, that when I'm drinking and I'm talking to somebody and there's a kind of a confrontational vibe in the situation, I'll just look for sore spots and continually probe them until I get a reaction from the other person. It's a bad habit. So anyway, on my best behavior, my best, most mindful, least confrontational behavior as I go into this very fraught political stage, this occasion which so many people will enter into with the intention of using it as a stage for ideological combat and physical combat. Again, if nothing else, I will be tweeting, and I will hashtag everything with Politicon. So follow me on Twitter, or at least, check in. While I'm there, I hope to meet up with Eric Knutson of the Root Simple podcast. We don't have a specific rendezvous scheduled just yet, but again, the invitation, if there's anybody in LA who would like to meet up and you're willing to come down to, the area around where Politicon is being held, get in touch with me. I'm afraid I won't be in a position to travel far afield from there. All right, that is all for this episode. Wish me safe travel and safe passage. I will have tales to tell when next I post one of these podcasts, which should be early next week. All right, thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. I will talk to you soon. Stay well.